May I begin by expressing some words of warm thanks to Mary Jacobus, to whom we all owe a great debt for the idea of this conference, and to whom I personally feel very grateful for this invitation to return to Cambridge to talk here. I'd like to say, too, that I'm especially pleased to be on the same platform as Marilyn Strathern, who is an old friend, but who is also, or and, has also been one of the most original thinkers in the humanities in Cambridge in our time. I also want to begin by emphasizing, and here I speak a trifle defensively, I must admit, that it was Mary Jacobus who proposed the topic that I shall be addressing this afternoon. And I did warn her that the effect of her invitation would be to produce a consequence highly congenial to me, although surely less entrancing for you, namely the certainty that I would talk mainly about myself. Well, all I can say about that is that there's not much that anyone can do about the fact that self-promotion would be the occupational hazard of academics if it were not their occupation. So, with your permission, I'll now pursue my occupation. I take as my starting point an excellent review article published by Brian Young in the current number of the Historical Journal, in which he discusses the views of the Cambridge School of Intellectual Historians about the philosophy of the Enlightenment. I mention Brian's essay because a number of colleagues have lately expressed some doubts as to whether it makes any sense to speak of such a Cambridge School of Intellectual History. By contrast, Young argues that a new method of studying the history of ideas was undoubtedly put forward in the course of the 1960s, and that a number of books appeared shortly afterwards in which this method, much to be associated with this university according to him, was duly put into practice. And he refers specifically to John Donne's book on John Locke of 1969, Duncan Forbes's on Hume of 1975, John Pocock's Machiavellian Moment of the same year, and indeed my own book, The Foundations of Modern Political Thought, which first appeared in 1978. Those books were all published by scholars with close and, in most cases, lifetime connections with this university. And I myself agree with Brian Young that the new approach he discusses was mainly articulated and defended in the course of the 1960s. If I were asked to be yet more specific about dates, I would single out the 15 years between 1957 and 1972. If there is a Cambridge School of Intellectual History, those were the years in which it was created. It was then that a challenge was mounted, I think, to a widely prevailing account of how the history of ideas should be written, and an alternative was proposed. Let me start, if I may, by sketching the assumptions that underpin the then prevailing account. Students of my generation were brought up to believe that the main business of intellectual historians is to interpret a so-called canon of classic texts in moral, social, political philosophy, and other purportedly allied disciplines. Those who argued in those terms did not, so far as I can see, wish to deny that you might prefer to study, say, some specific political issue and the pamphleteering associated with it at some specific moment of political change. However, the value of studying intellectual history was held to be intimately connected with an emphasis on a canon. And that was because this canon of classic texts was taken to contain what the textbook writers of this period, and I shall quote a number of them, liked to describe, and I'm quoting, as a dateless wisdom in the form of universal ideas. Or I quote from Professor John Plamanas, the professor of political theory at the University of Oxford in this period, we can hope to learn and benefit directly from investigating these timeless elements in the classic text, since they possess a perennial relevance. So, the right way to approach these classic texts, the argument went on, must therefore be to concentrate on what they contribute to an understanding of these fundamental concepts and abiding questions of morality, politics, social life. To put it more crudely, as Plamenatz also did, actually he was rather a connoisseur of putting things crudely, we must be prepared to read these texts as if they were written by our exact contemporaries. And indeed, it was held to be essential to approach them in those ways. I quote once more, "If we allow ourselves to become sidetracked into examining the social conditions or the intellectual context out of which these texts arose, we shall run the risk of losing sight of their dateless wisdom, thereby losing contact with the value and purpose of studying them." Now, that project was always more ideological than its exponents cared to admit, as becomes evident if you reflect for a moment on the special prominence that was always accorded to the early modern period, partly the classical, but mainly the early modern period of European intellectual history. And that, of course, was an emphasis that historians of the Cambridge School found themselves committed to replicating if they were going to engage, as they wished to do, in dialogue with the dominant paradigm. And the alleged justification of this special prominence, actually, you find very artlessly expressed in various works of moral and political philosophy that were published as late as the early 1970s. For example, John Rawls's then celebrated Theory of Justice, from which you gather, you're told at the outset, that what made such classic texts of moral and political reflection as those of Hobbes or of Locke or of Rousseau so particularly classic was that it was there in which you find the founding moments of the theory of consent, of the social contract, of natural rights. That's to say, what is for someone like Rawls, the recognizable contours of the sort of political philosophy that you want. They were talking, you might say, about what we ought to be talking about. Well, it's easy from this historical distance to see that that dominant paradigm, as I'm calling it, and the Kuhnian overtones are deliberate here because Kuhn was a presiding genius over much of the change that took place. This dominant paradigm was always maintained, I think, only with a certain strain. It was embarrassing, for example, that the fundamental concepts were sometimes discussed, even by the canonical figures, in such a fragmentary way that exegetes had to supply them with the doctrines which they had unaccountably failed to discuss. It was even more embarrassing that so many of the canonical theorists failed to talk about some of what were agreed to be the fundamental issues. I quote a commentator of that time on John Locke, "It is unfortunate that the two treatises of government have nothing to tell us either about race or the prospects for world government." What about Hobbes? Well, one commentator of the time complains, I quote again, "Despite his obviously systematic aspirations, he has nothing to tell us about the significance of public opinion polls." Well, as those carefully chosen examples already indicate, it struck some of us in the 1960s that this paradigm was rather enticingly open to ridicule. And the two methodological pronouncements of those years that are still principally cited as the manifestos of the so-called Cambridge School, it seems to me now, were actually satires. One is John Donne's classic essay of 1968, The Identity of the History of Ideas. I mean, the satire begins with the title. The other, I cannot avoid mentioning, was my own article of 1969, Meaning and Understanding in the History of Ideas, which remains, somewhat disconcertingly, exactly 40 years later, by far the most widely cited text I've ever produced. So what struck us and our co-agitators as misleading and even absurd about the dominant paradigm? Well, to recover the standpoint from which our satires were composed, we need, I think, to begin with what I take to be the opening years of the Cambridge campaign, and those were the years between 1957 and 1960. The first year saw the publication of John Pocock's book, The Ancient Constitution and the Feudal Law, which has never been out of print. The second, the publication of Peter Laslett's edition of John Locke's Two Treatises of Government, which has likewise never been out of print in the whole ensuing half century. Both those works addressed figures who were held at the time to be canonical in the history of political theory. Pocock's book contains chapters on James Harrington and on Sir Edward Coke, while Laslett's contribution was, of course, largely centred on the still more obviously classic figure of John Locke. But what Laslett and Pocock both suggested was that the best way to approach and understand such major theorists was by way of attending to the local political debates in which they were taking part. So, James Harrington's celebrated views, which have been so much picked up in Marxist historiography, about the relationship between land and power, are best understood, Pocock sensationally suggested, only if you understand the debate that was going on in early 17th century England about the character of feudal tenures. In the absence of that background, you really will have little understanding of why those issues are addressed by Harrington as they are. Likewise, Laslett, with Locke's discussion of the theory of natural rights in the Second Treatise, Locke, according to Laslett, has to be seen as making an intervention in a particular political debate, specifically of the years 1679 to 81, when the issue was whether the heir presumptive could be excluded from the throne. And to understand Locke's treatise, he wanted to say, is to understand that it's a pamphlet within that debate. Well, those were sensational interventions and extremely influential upon persons like myself. But it is true that both Pocock and Laslett's work remain susceptible of being dismissed, and duly was dismissed, from the perspective of the dominant paradigm, as being instances — this was completely congenial to exponents of the dominant paradigm, of course it couldn't go too far — but of writers whom had been supposed to be canonical, but had now been shown not to be. And indeed, Laslett, interestingly, clearly saw his own work in that light. If you look at the chapter in his introduction of 1960 on the relationship between Locke and Hobbes, what he wants you to understand is, of course, that Thomas Hobbes is an architectonic political philosopher whose thinking completely transcends his age. By contrast, he wants to say, with John Locke, a local pamphleteer. And for Laslett, that contrast remained extremely important, because what he saw himself as having done was an act of dethroning. With the publication of John Donne's monograph on John Locke in 1969, that reaction was effectively blocked off. Donne treats Locke as an unequivocally canonical figure, recognizing that the Second Treatise of Government contains well-worked-out views on many of the concepts usually taken to be definitive of modern political theory, including — and Donne wrote specifically and separately also about these concepts — consent, freedom, political obligation, distributive justice. So the very strong engagement with his own teacher, Laslett, there. This is not a pamphleteer. This is a major philosopher of politics. However, Donne insisted at the same time, Locke's handling of these concepts cannot be understood except in the most densely historical terms. Here he reverts to a theme which Laslett had already made prominent, namely that it's impossible to recapture why Locke's text has the structure and organisation that it has in the absence of attending to the political issues specific to the 1680s. But perhaps more important was Donne's winkling out of the largely unspoken presuppositions of the structure of the theory, and an attempt to get you to see that in the absence of a natural theology which is not spelt out, much of the theory of consent and natural rights doesn't really make any sense. So that if you take away the natural law theory, you're not left with a more modern-looking theory, you're left with a theory which has no motivation for its own author. May I say — I mean, I'm going to say, Mary told me to say — that while Donne was writing that pathfinding book, I was attempting, much less systematically, to say something similar about the political philosophy of Thomas Hobbes. This was in a series of articles I published between 1964 and 1969. Hobbes was the political philosopher who had most of all been treated by exponents of the dominant paradigm as someone who had constructed a completely systematic and architectonic theory of politics, centred on the notion of representation and giving rise to a view of rights, consent, and political obligation. Now, I tried to show that you can't make sense of any of Hobbes's claims about those concepts without recognising that his theory was put forward as a solution to a specific set of questions raised by the founding of the English Republic in 1649, in particular, the question as to whether the new republican government was legitimate, and, even if it were not, whether it might nevertheless be lawful to obey it. And I went so far as to suggest that the right way to understand Hobbes's Leviathan is simply to see it as a contribution to that debate. And if you don't see that that's what's motivating and driving the text, you won't understand much about its contents. Well, if that's your standpoint, it's easy to see why so much of the prevailing commentary on the canonical figures struck us as absurd. We'd come to believe that it makes no sense to assume that even major texts of political philosophy are attempting to do the same thing, that's to say, to analyse the concepts purportedly definitive of the discipline. And we'd come to think that the right way, the only way to make good sense of these texts is anthropologically, to treat them as artifacts of an alien culture, and to do whatever an anthropologist, a cultural anthropologist, would do in order to try to make sense of such an artifact. Well, I fear, but of course I also hope, that nowadays those commitments will sound the merest common sense. But during the 1960s, that view was challenged, and I may say violently challenged, by some powerful traditions of thought. One reaction came from the followers of Leo Strauss, perhaps the strongest defenders of the canonical approach then as now. John Pocock, who moved in the late 1960s to work in the United States, soon found himself embroiled in very heated exchanges with Straussians. But I think it would be fair to say that, rightly or wrongly, no one back in Cambridge felt the need to take that challenge at all seriously. However, a second and more troubling reaction came from the then powerful tradition of Marxist historiography, especially as expressed in this country in the work of Christopher Hill, and above all, by C.B. Macpherson, Canadian philosopher, whose book, The Political Theory of Possessive Individualism, Hobbes to Locke, was published to widespread acclaim in 1962. According to Macpherson, there was something that all the most celebrated figures in early modern Anglophone political theory were doing. They were all reflecting on the underlying socioeconomic forces in their society, and specifically on what Macpherson labelled their possessively individualist character. And that, he argued, offers you the key to understanding the preoccupations not just of Hobbes and Locke, the heroes of his book, but also the levellers, James Harrington, as well. The Marxist undergirding of that book is now very plain to see, isn't it? Social being determines consciousness. The social being common to these philosophers is that of a new society of market relations. So what could political theory be other than a reflection upon, and indeed a vindication of, those relations? Well, that set of Marxist approaches, in particular Macpherson's book, opened up, I think, a second front, you might say, in the battle about method being waged by the Cambridge scholars I've mentioned. They weren't, of course, alone in criticising Macpherson's form of reductionism, but there was a specifically Cambridge response to this kind of Marxist history, which arose out of what I might call a kind of pointillisme that had been starting to characterise a Cambridge approach. That's to say, the denial that there's any one set of preoccupations to be placed upon any of these writers. Pocock, whose major methodological article was published in 1962, and I quote, says, "Political writers operate at different levels and with different purposes. The aim must be to reconstruct what they were doing, so far as possible, on their own terms." Well, I've never ceased to believe that that pointillist reaction, as I'm calling it, is basically right-minded. Although, if I might speak simply about myself for a moment, I also came to feel that there is something more general that needs to be said about the activity of thinking about politics, and that's something connected with the legitimization of public life. So I agree with the Marxist view that what we have to do is to think of social life as setting the problems for the political theorist. But I take the characteristic role of such theorists not to be that of unselfconsciously reflecting on the socio and economic relations of their society, but of arguing in such a way, rather self-consciously, as I would want to say, arguing in such a way as either to legitimize or to seek to delegitimize some particular and prevailing practice of that society. And that commitment gave me a further and strong reason for wanting to deny any categorical distinction between so-called classic texts and political speeches and pamphlets. And indeed, I recklessly went on record as saying that I could see no difference in principle between Hobbes's Leviathan and a speech in Parliament. I mean, it would be a long speech, but it would be not categorically different. Furthermore, since what you can do in politics is always limited by what you can hope to legitimize, I also felt and still feel that there's no strong distinction to be marked between political theory and praxis. Political theory, on this account, simply appears as a mode of seeking to legitimize or delegitimize various practices. Well, again, I fear but also hope that that sounds the merest common sense in these post-Habermasian times. But at the time I'm speaking of, which was pre-Habermasian times, these commitments were vehemently challenged by philosophers who wished to restate a dominant paradigm. And one particularly fierce response came from Professor Howard Warrender, who had published a major study of Hobbes in 1957, and 10 years later published a remarkably violent denunciation of my own work on Hobbes in the House Journal of the Cambridge University Faculty of History, the historical journal, which shortly afterwards published an even more vituperative attack on my work by Michael Oakeshott, causing me to wonder what my colleagues were quite up to. But an earlier challenge, and this I think must have been aimed much more at Pocock and Laslett, had already come from Professor John Plamonatz, who included in his massive study of 1964, Man and Society, a theoretical introduction with a renewed defense of the need to focus on the classic texts. Plamonatz goes back to Hobbes, as they tended to do, and wishes to tell us that what is important about Hobbes is that he offers us the concepts that explicate the modern notion of the state. These are the concepts, he says, and I'm now quoting, on which we must concentrate as exegesis. And he added the fighting words, as they by then were, that to understand Hobbes, we do not need to know what his purpose may have been in writing Leviathan, and certainly not to know what he may have thought about the rival claims of royalists and parliamentarians in the English Civil War. Now, I had come by that stage to believe that Hobbes's Leviathan is actually about the rival claims of royalists and parliamentarians in the English Civil War. It's not about anything else, as a matter of fact. And that you can't understand any of the discussion of representation or sovereignty in the absence of that background. But Plamonatz's view was that that commitment simply embodies a failure to understand what's involved in the process of recovering the meaning of a text. And that's the point that it was increasingly made by other critics of the Cambridge School. The aim of interpretation, these critics wanted to say, is of course to recover the meanings of texts, but that is an activity that requires us only to examine the texts themselves. To focus on the historical circumstances in which they were written is to focus on something else. So a version of the so-called intentionalist fallacy was being presented. The claim was it's simply a confusion to suppose that questions about motivation and intentionality are part of interpretation. So very strong, although recognizably traditional, picture of the hermeneutic task. Well, my recollection of how this is the last part of what I want to say. By the way, I was told to talk for 35 minutes. Is that right? I'm going to talk for 35 minutes, and I've talked for 28. My recollection of how the battle was then joined is that, in fact, it was mainly John Donne and myself who took up that charge, and we did so by invoking a specifically Wittgensteinian view of how to think about the relations between meaning and the understanding of utterances, shifting the balance, as Wittgenstein of the Investigations insisted we should, from talk about meanings — you shouldn't talk about meanings, you should talk about use. That commitment is certainly present in John's classic article of 1968, and I myself published a series of articles about the theory of speech acts from 1966 to 72. What I believed then, and still believe, and I think it's fundamental, is that the concept of understanding is not a purely semantic one. There are two separable senses in which you may be interested in the understanding and hence in the meaning of an utterance. You may be concerned with what we usually call linguistic meaning, the sense and reference that purportedly attaches to words or phrases or sentences, or you may be interested in linguistic action, that is, with the range of things that speakers and writers may be capable of doing in and by the use of words and sentences. You may be interested, that is, in recovering what particular writers may have meant by what they said, how they intended the utterance to be understood. So to put it grandly, the philosophical claim I'm putting forward is that to understand an utterance, you need a grasp of meaning in both senses. What the utterance itself may have meant, if anything, and what the act of uttering it may have meant. So to express the contrasting claim in the slogan I adopted from J.L. Austin, the process of understanding requires a grasp not just of meaning, but of speech acts, and of speech acts far more than this doubtful notion of meaning. So I was trying to reply to Plamenats with the lie direct. If the identification of speech acts is part of the project of understanding, then the contention that it's possible to understand a text simply by recovering the meaning of what it says is an identifiable philosophical error. Rather, you need the two aspects of the hermeneutic that I was trying to put forward. Now, it was that contention which I think caused the greatest dismay in the 1960s. As Warrender was to put it in his critique of my own work, and here echoing many other objections, this is to remove the philosophical point of studying the history of ideas and to leave us with nothing but the dustiest form of antiquarianism in its place. Well, to round off, it always seemed to me that the next phase in the Cambridge campaign should have been to answer that criticism. But it must be admitted that at that point, we're at 1972 now, Cambridge historians parted company with each other. John Pocock, like Duncan Forbes, went on to write works of history in the 1970s in which they seemed to feel no need to address these wider questions. Pocock even went on to write a kind of history in which the characteristic Cambridge emphasis on interventions and hence agency were abandoned in favour of studying political languages themselves. And meanwhile, John Donne began to speak about the capacity to recover for our own immediate purposes some of the values that were to be found in the early modern texts. I have never felt that sense of cultural continuity, and insofar as I continued along these lines, it was to suggest something more along the lines of buried treasure. Not that we should be motivated by the desire to find it, but that historians do characteristically find it if they're patient enough in their anthropological excavations. As I now hardly need to stress, however, I'm talking about a number of strongly contrasting research programs which, as I've suggested, fan out from the early 1970s. What turns out in retrospect was that, although there may not now be a discriminable school, there was a moment when a lot of us felt we had common adversaries, and that gave us a project. It was essentially a critical and even satirical project, after the accomplishment of which we went our separate ways. So it seems to me, to come to a close, exactly 35 minutes, that the Cambridge School is best seen as one of many contributions to that large-scale process of challenging established pieties in the academy, no less than in society at large, that was simply characteristic of the 1960s. Now, it's true that the 1960s have for long been castigated by reactionary moralists. The world is full of reactionary moralists nowadays, isn't it? And it is seen as a period of general mayhem and mess. But to me, it still seems that bliss was it in that dawn to be alive. And even if it wasn't very heaven to be in Cambridge, and it certainly wasn't, it was a great deal of fun. Thanks very much.